I'm driven by people's pain and suffering. I think that no one should have to suffer and not have help that they need. And I think struggling in life is necessary because it's how we decide what we want, is by experiencing what we don't want. But suffering and not knowing a way out is not necessary. Like I said, I've been meditating since I'm 11, and I don't know how I would have survived this long in life without knowing how to connect internally to myself and how important it was to connect to others and be a part of something bigger than I am.
Hi everyone, welcome to another Psychedelic Conversations. We have Cherie Kaplan today with us. Thank you so much for creating this time to be speaking with us. Pleasure to have you.
Oh, so pleasure. My pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Just to give a context to our listeners, I'd like to share a few lines from your bio and then we can take it from there, if that's okay.
That sounds great.
Thank you. Cherie is a leading expert in mental health treatment and plant formulations, uses transformative approach of mental health care, emphasizes the power of integrative protocols that blend traditional therapy and medical treatment with innovative practices, including biopsychosocial evaluations, plant medicine, ketamine-assisted therapy, trauma, mind, body work, breath work, nutrition, and fitness, movement, music, and personal transformative practices. Cherie is passionate about educating others, other clinicians in applied clinical practices of integrative mental health and psychedelic-assisted therapy. There's so many questions I would like to ask before we begin, but let's talk about your story. What brings you to this work?
Oh, wow. I think what brought me to mental health to begin with was I had gone through a challenge myself in my life, and I got into therapy. And when I got into therapy, I realized that everything in life was a choice. How we relate to our thoughts are a choice, how we relate to our body, our, you know, people's boundaries. And I just had no idea. And so that's how I applied to graduate school. And once I became a clinician, years later, my son was born with a central nervous system disorder. And I wanted to, he had like different things going on in his brain, concrete wise, like there was brain damage in his frontal lobe. He had something growing in mass effect on his hippocampus. He had a movement disorder and a seizure disorder. So he actually presented like he had severe autism, but I knew that's not what it was because I had worked with kids who had autism. So I started, I got my MRIs and EEGs, and we actually found what I just said. And so I wanted to see if I could fire and wire his brain around the areas that weren't working because he was having a hard time running and coordinating his walking. He couldn't talk. He was like a hand flapping, circle spinning 4-year-old, nonverbal. And so I started studying neuroanatomy to figure out what parts of the brain, what parts of the body could activate what parts of the brain, and to see if I could use sound frequencies to wire around things. And so in that process, I started working with plants because plants can also work on sound frequencies. And so between movement and music and tuning forks, and then of course, if you're sending sound through a body, you want to make sure that the nutrients are right and there's enough hydration. And so it just got me on this incredible search for what are all the different components that's going to make his body function. And I'd also been meditating since I'm 11 years old. So, And I had had my own traumatic injury in my brain when I was younger. So I think the combination of healing myself between meditation and exercise and music and movement and studying neuroanatomy. It just kind of all came together with me. And then the plants to me were like, ooh, I have like a little magic wand to help get the body back into homeostasis, where you use the body's natural ability to self-correct and self-heal. So it was kind of like a whole bunch of different ways that brought me here.
Yes, that's so wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing. That's really lovely to hear, because it kind of helps our listeners to connect, because we always love and connect with the real life stories, how people seek and, you know, come to understanding, and also then later teaching and providing these educational resources. So I really appreciate that. Mental health is at the moment is the big thing. As you already know, and you're in the space. And what are you seeing? What's happening at the moment? Because if you've been in it for a long time, from, you know, previous past to now, and maybe like future predictions, what are we dealing with in your words?
So I'm from New York City originally. And so I have my scope of who I worked with in New York City. And I always say that I work with so many different socioeconomic and cultural groups. And then when I moved to Florida, I moved to a very affluent area. And yet I was always connected with doctors and helped doctors through their treatment as well. So I would get another diverse population. And I have a very big part of my heart is for these children in foster care, because I feel like they are the forgotten people, and they have been taken from their homes. They've been abused or neglected already. And then we bring them into a very broken system. And so I feel like I get to cover the gamut when I help people from all different backgrounds. So I will say that we're all dealing with similar things, just different narratives, right? So once the body goes into fight or flight, we all are in the same place. Our brain and body goes into lockdown, you know, our processing goes off, our memory goes off. If you stay in that state for a long enough period of time where you either have traumatic or chronic stress, the part of your brain that we call your limbic system, which is where all your senses coordinate together so that your brain can give a meaning to what you're experiencing, that can be overactive. There can be a hyper state. So now there's a hypersensitivity, and your perceptions can be off, your memory can be off. And so I think regardless of how you got to your mental health being thrown off, whether it's anxiety, depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder, we're seeing a lot of everything as a result of chronic or traumatic stress. So whether you have had relational stress or trauma through parenting and growing up with parents who were maybe overworked, overstressed, or parents who had trauma themselves, you may have relational anxieties or avoidance, or, you know, if you had, you know, bullying or medical issues very early on in life, that's going to affect your body's fight or flight. And then if you fast forward through all the many different chronic or traumatic stresses that happen, and you bring it up to what's happened with COVID and what's happened in our political environment and our world environment, I think there's a huge sense of I'm not safe and I'm powerless. And I think that when we have so much global chaos going on, I think that's when people start getting stuck in fight or flight by scrolling through social media, by being on the news and seeing all this. And that can be very overwhelming, but it can also get us stuck in that fight, flight, or freeze response. So I think that we have to help patients scale things down to being aware of our impact globally, but what's happening right here and right now? And how do I get in this present moment? And where do I find my points of power in this moment? And so we really need to be teaching people about how to regulate their body's fight or flight, and how to focus their minds, and how to do the repair work that gets our body back into that state where you can be in charge and you can be back in control of what you think and what you feel, and being able to just look at it and redirect yourself. But I think we need some skills and tools in order to do that. And I think we need to get out there and really teach protocols to clinicians for brief treatment and extended treatment, so that we can help more people in our population and not just say, think positive and focus on something else and be grateful, and that's going to be enough. Because although those are great things to be able to incorporate into your lifestyle, they're not the solution out of the starting gate. Like, you need to do some of the repair work and have some skills and tools to self-regulate and focus your mind, which means we need to know and understand as clinicians how processing problems happen and what exercises, both physically and verbally, we can do to correct it. So that's my long-winded, you asked a big question. I had to give you a big answer.
Thank you so much. And would you say that it's increasing, it's getting, is it becoming more complex, or is it because we're kind of, because of the technology and the information is being passed very quickly, instantly, we are accessing probably why we think it's increasing. Do you think it's always been a problem for the humans to have these mental health challenges from the beginning of time, let's say? Or some people like to say that, oh, it's because we're becoming more and more disconnected due to the industrial revolution. Therefore, there is an individualization going on and incentivized, in ways that wasn't there before. Now we are becoming more like the selfie culture, it's all about me and my world. And that is increasing. Therefore, the mental health challenges are increasing. Would you agree?
If you go to statistics, right, the statistics are affected by what's happening in the world also. But I just think very common sense wise, where initially we lived in a very barbaric society, right? I mean, think about centuries ago, what was going on. You might not have known what was happening past your village, but that could be a very barbaric village. I mean, they were hanging people. They were putting people on crosses. They were, there were witch trials. There's so many crazy things that could provoke anxiety within your village. It's still the relational stresses and what have you. Maybe there was more support, and maybe there was more connection, and maybe that made it more helpful. But I know through the study of Dorothea Dix, way back when, at the turn of the century and after, that she was going into people's barns and finding people who had neurological disorders in cages and in prisons. They were keeping them in back rooms and freezing them out. And so I think mental health has been a challenge, and neurological health has been a challenge, always. But I think that we're creating more problems with social media. So kids who might not have had problems are, seeing people's fake lives on air. And then, God knows what happens with all of the, how you can take a video and clip it and change it and create whatever stories you want to create. So I think it's a very confusing time, but I think people are provoking fear and power. And I think it's causing a lot of feelings of unsafety and powerlessness. And so I think it probably is more global. And it's not just being reported that way, because we're not staying connected in our individual communities, and we're not seeing a realistic sense of interdependence. And I think that's dangerous.
Yeah, fully on board with this. Really appreciate that as well, your perspective on it. I always had my own doubts about the medieval times, like the pre, you know, like the history, you know, and also like, let's not be naive to think that the indigenous cultures always had it love and light. And, you know, like, I think maybe it's to do with the capacity that we can discern and understand, you know, how human relations work. And also, the predispositions, right? There is a lot that not really covered in the mainstream where, for example, you know, I love Dr. Bezel's the trial or the study they did on veterans where, you know, they would, he would always say, you know, not every soldier comes back with PTSD and what right. determines what, you know, what's going on there and so on. And I always thought, especially like nowadays, there's a lot of activism going on in the world, like for peace and rallying for like stop the war and everything. And then there's a lot of raw images online. And I'm thinking, just to give you an example, I was speaking to somebody from my community and this person was feeling absolutely in despair looking at all the images from the current, I don't want to take the conversation to the what's happening now politically, but she was looking at all of these images from what's happening now in Middle East, to you know, in Palestine, and a lot of PTSD sort of, or maybe even stressful symptoms were coming up for her, just because thinking that people in the war zones are absolutely must be terrified and absolutely, you know. But then what we, you know, what I was thinking that we don't understand fully, I guess when you live in a situation like that, the body will adapt, right? The body will produce cortisol, adrenaline, like whatever needs the body needs in order to survive in that environment. And if somebody is over in a Western country in a comfortable couch, you know, looking at these raw images and their body is not in that state of preparation for what's, because, you know, they're not really experiencing, it's not happening over here, but it's happening over another part of the world. I always thought that this can cause more trauma than, I don't know if I'm making this clear, but I think what I'm saying is that sometimes when we're not prepared and we look at these raw images online, we can actually can be traumatized equally or even if not worse, dare I say.
I agree. I think that, you know, when you are in a state of chronic traumatic stress, you adapt and you start learning a new mindset. That doesn't mean you're not getting wear and tear in the body. It just means that it becomes your new normal. I think we all experienced that during COVID. It's like we were shocked being trapped in our homes, but then people started adapting and, you know, some people felt like, yay, freedom, you know, and other people were just became more and more isolated and it became more and more painful. And I think that's where you look at people's predispositions and also their mindset and what kind of attachments they had early on. So depending on how you relate to stress is going to depend on whether that is traumatic or not. So if I'm in a situation that is chronically traumatic and stressful and I adapt to it, and some people will and some people won't, right? So if I adapt well, even though I'm going to be causing damage to my system, staying in that heightened state for that long period of time, it's not as jarring and people will come out of that and it's going to be a slow healing process because it became so normal to them. And so things will happen later on as their body gets used to being in a peaceful environment and having to adapt back to a more peaceful environment. So you're like living, like you said, you're in your living room, you have food, clothing, shelter, you're safe. And all of a sudden you're watching these images. That's going to like set you into a fast state of fight or flight. And if you're feeling powerless, and you get into this feedback loop of watching and I'm powerless and watching and I'm powerless. That can be just as traumatizing or more, depending on who you are.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. I mean, of course, the disclaimer is that we're not asking everyone to just shut the TVs and the screens, but I'm just saying not be numb to what's going on. Of course, you know, we all feel it and we all want to somehow bring solutions, which is kind of the biggest, you know, problem at the moment. But I mean, I understand, like, from your work and your perspective, if we can, as our little own private containers over here, do our own individual work and become fully functioning agent people, then I guess that's kind of a good step forward in the right direction.
Well, I always say we all have a point of power somewhere, right? And if we are a microcosm of the macrocosm, right? So if we're just a smaller piece of a larger planet Earth, then doesn't it make sense that our point of power is to be contribute to society in the most positive way and use our creativity to expand how we are of service to each other in our communities? So when people feel powerless from watching what's happening globally, I try to get them to come back to their world and where can they make an impact? What parts of the community can they give to? How do they share their gifts? And I say to our older patients and our patients who have disabilities, I'm like, I don't care if you go into Starbucks and hold the door and smile at people and say good morning and please and thank you and value the people that you see. Just look them in the eye and say good morning, or however you feel comfortable connecting. That's bringing about connection and generating, if you will, more compassion and love in our culture and our society. And I do believe that, you know, whatever you focus on expands. And the more we can spread goodwill, you know, throughout our community and our interaction with others and how we share our gifts, I think the more we will have a larger impact globally. Because when people are in fear, they're very impressionable. Right. And you can get them to do some really crazy, painful things. But if people feel connection and support and safety and certainty in an uncertain time, and they can start feeling an interconnection in their communities, I think it will be much harder for us to be influenced in a negative way.
Yeah. Yeah. This is so valuable. Thank you so much. Before moving to the plant medicine conversation, if you don't mind talking a little bit about the predisposition for our listeners, if this is the first time they're hearing about, what is a predisposition anyway?
There is a much larger clinical definition than what I'm going to say, but for the purposes of your audience, like, I think we all come to this planet when we arrive as babies. And there are certain gifts we have and certain strengths we have just waking up in the morning, right? There are some people whose circadian rhythms are, like, you know, spot on in the morning. And there are other people who are spot on at night. And, you know, interesting that we have hospitals that function 24 hours. You know, you have to, you know, where does your circadian rhythm fit for that, right? So there are people who are meant to do certain jobs. Like, I'm not meant to be an artist, but my daughter can, like, crank insane pieces of art out in 30 minutes. So maybe she's supposed to make the world beautiful and share that in many different ways and, you know, teach other people how to share that in different ways. And maybe my gifts are about learning neuroanatomy and psychology and how to support someone in learning how to take charge of their bodies and their minds so that they can use their gifts and move forward in life. So then there's the impact on who you are, your strengths, just as an individual before you ever you know, have interaction with mother, father, or lack thereof, or mother, mother, father, father, or, you know, whoever is raising you, your guardians, those connections will then build strengths, or may not. You know, it can cause security or insecurities. So very early on, there's the gifts you come to the planet with, and then there's what happens to you in those first 3 to 7 years of life. And I think there are different markers that different things are more impressionable. So now, as things happen in life, I have certain skills and tools in how I relate to them naturally, or how my attachments early on have impacted the way that I relate to them. So it's really important to be able to, at some point in time in our life, and this is supposed to happen like in your, you know, in your 20s, but it's never too early and it's never too late to start self-reflecting, taking inventory of your strengths, your deficits, your positive beliefs, your negative beliefs, and learning like, ooh, like certain things are not good. Like, I don't believe I'm worthy. Why don't I believe I'm worthy? Well, my connection to my primary caregivers was broken in some way. The trust was betrayed. There was an insecure or an anxious way that I was connected to my parents. So if I don't feel a connection, I will not feel a sense of belonging. And if I don't feel a sense of belonging, I don't feel a sense of worthiness, right? So if other people came along in your life that you felt connected to early enough life, you could have a sense of belonging somewhere else, and you could develop that sense of worthiness, but you might still have to go back and repair that attachment. So therefore, we need to have a lot of clinicians who understand infancy trauma and nonverbal trauma, and how do we use the brain, the mind, you know, and the whole self to be able to correct and repair that. And what skills and tools do I need in my toolbox as a clinician to help somebody? And how much of this work can be done by myself at home without a clinician? And when is it time to get help to support me in doing some of the repair work and learning some of the tools so that I can move forward in my life? Like, I don't think people are supposed to sit in therapy their whole lives. I think come in, heal, go home, tell everybody else how you got better. You know, but I think that the predisposition and what happens early on in life is there's so many indications, like your learning style, like how you learn matters and how you take in information matters. So if you have somebody who had an auditory processing problem and then they're traumatized, you know, their auditory system and their auditory memory is going to like really clamp down on them. Right. So you, if you don't understand how to correct auditory processing and you're a therapist, like that's a problem. Or you need to know like who you're going to collaborate with to help you if you don't know. Right. If somebody has, you know, ocular motor issues, so they're born where like one eye, both eyes don't focus on the same point, that's going to be very difficult for your brain to coordinate what it is seeing, because even the focal points are two different locations, and what you're hearing, your brain has to coordinate that together. So decoding, organizing, and sequencing information. And now we live in a society, and I don't know how many times I hear in a day, I have attention deficit disorder. And I'm like, everybody has attention deficit disorder at some point. Why does yours get stuck? Right. And that's usually because the brain got jammed up in a processing venue somewhere. So one of the senses got jammed up or got affected in lockdown. And that part of the brain didn't get circuited to or didn't develop as quickly as the other parts, like with children. Right. But with trauma, when you have chronic and traumatic stress, your processing is locked up. And so we have to look at how do we unlock the limbic system, the vestibular system, how do we strengthen the vagus nerve and all those areas? So yes, I think we each come into it neurobiologically uniquely with our own gifts uniquely. And then what actually happens in our environment impacts us And all of that will determine, like, will have an impact, not determine, but will have an impact on how we experience stress or traumatic stress.
This is so profound and valuable. Thank you so much. And this is a great way to merge into the psychedelic assisted therapy. And I can already feel why it has to be done really well. You know, considering all the pointers that you've just mentioned, I can already see how important it is to work with the right facilitator, the right therapist, and the right structures and systems, and also understanding the individual's needs and their functioning and their own systems. Could you please talk to us about that? And especially now that psychedelics are being mainstreamed and everybody thinks it's just a magic thing that you just do in the, and then these medicines can do the work for you. What are your thoughts on that?
You know, I probably have some unpopular thoughts and some that I think a lot of people agree with. And so I think it depends on what brings you to psychedelics, right? I don't know a lot of people who don't need repair work from earlier on in life. And if you do have attachment issues, if there was some kind of chronic or traumatic stress, then you're going to have to do some kind of work in order for those psychedelics to be really impactful. But let's just say that you had somebody and they had really good, you know, upbringing. There was absolutely no traumatic or chronic stress. I don't know who that would be, but say you did your work already. You know, say you're a grown-up and you've gone through your repair work and you're feeling pretty good, but you're just having a lot of stress in business. That's probably the person who could enjoy trying a psychedelic and seeing what happens, you know, with anyone. However, I do believe that how you process information and the condition your body is in matters, because psychedelics not only give you insight and give you opportunities that if you focus on deliberate intentions before you take them, and they will give you awareness of yourself, of others, of a situation, of perspective, of creative ideas. But there's a biochemical part of it. So, for example, I've seen people who don't need their serotonin receptors stimulated and don't need any more serotonin, and they take psilocybin mushrooms and they do not have a positive experience, and it makes them very anxious because they don't need that in their body. So even though they could get awareness and insight, the physical experience of the medicine is not pleasant. So I think a lot of people will sit there and say, well, it's something you needed to learn. And I don't know that that's true all the time. Because if you did do your work and it's a matter of your body is balanced in a certain way, maybe you don't need that medicine. And so I think that it's important to evaluate these certain factors to see like what medicine is going to be right for you. For example, we do ketamine-assisted therapy at my office with Dr. Michelle Wiener, and we also work out of Miami, and she has offices in Hollandale or Hollywood as well. And so ketamine, you know, works on different biochemistry than psilocybin does, right? So just to kind of shorten the conversation, you're dealing more with glutamate and GABA and oxytocin and dopamine. So what do you do if you have a person who has very dysregulated dopamine or overproduces dopamine? Is that the right medicine to choose for your patient? You know, and it may not be, or you may have to put other things in play in order to be able to use that kind of medicine. So if you don't have somebody who has a team or a handle on how somebody's body processes what's going on in somebody's body medically, I think you could potentially give them the wrong medicine. Like MDMA is also going to, you know, elevate your oxytocin, your dopamine, serotonin. So we need to be mindful of what's happening for a person prior to giving them the medications. And also, again, everything I mentioned earlier on their learning style, their attachments, like you could be putting somebody into a dangerous situation without the right guidance and support and focus going in and coming out. So what I see a lot is people come to us after they've been away on an ayahuasca retreat or peyote or taking these medicines. And, you know, and I see people who grow up in villages are training their whole life to take these medicines. They have support from their villages to take these medicines. And there's more than just the medicine. There's a whole developmental learning process. There's a whole emotional identity process. Like, what is your role process? And so the day comes where they get these medicines. And again, I'm making it a very simplistic experience to a very beautiful and in-depth cultural experience. But they're prepared for their medicine. And to me, just saying to somebody, what's your intention, is not preparation. And not being able to go into somebody's mind and help them pull together different strengths for them to enter into their experience and maybe do some preparation and some repair work before they actually get the medicines. And then afterwards, continue with that work and the repair work so that they can actually use the medicine as a lubricant in their healing and use the insights to then create new neural networks and prune the old negative beliefs and establish the new ones. So my unpopular belief is, if you're going to do this and you didn't grow up in a village and you didn't have all that training, I do believe having a clinician to help and support you when you've had chronic or traumatic stress or any kind of mental health issue is extremely helpful. I'm not saying that people can't take psilocybin mushrooms and get better without that kind of guidance. I'm just saying it's a slippery slope.
Thank you so much for validating this, because this is sort of like what we bring to our listeners in the community about that, how important it is and how critical it is to recognize that we are the first container, you know, like you have on your bio, the biopsychosocial history and the, you know, the memories and the biochemistry of the entire container is what interacts with the medicine. It's not the other way around. It's not like we take the medicine, medicine comes in and does these things, but I always felt like we have far more superior biochemicals that can shut down, that can change you into something else or transmute it into different things. Like, for example, Dr. James Fadiman, once he said, sometimes like for LSD, somebody was asking about what's the difference between LSA and LSD. And what was so interesting to me, he said, sometimes, you know, this psychedelic compound can be taken, doesn't matter what this is, LSA or whatever they want to call it, but then the body can turn it into LSD. So that was really fascinating that it's our biochemistry that is interacting with the compounds and the chemicals of the plants or the medicines or the substances. So that's why I really value what you said and shared. And also, you're the first person I heard the word from prune. I love that word. I love that word. I think it's just so relevant and it really resonated with me. So now we can go into this segue into understanding that it is not the medicine that we seek out. It's, first of all, we need to do our repair, in your words, like repair work or some sort of inventory work so that we can understand what are we doing there? Are we understanding our fears, our limitations, our psychological processes, or maybe even biological symptoms and stresses? Like, what are we doing in that process exactly?
Yeah, and I think that people, a lot of times they don't know what their life would look like if they did prune that negative belief or way of being in the world. And sometimes what's stopping them is what comes next and the uncertainty of what comes next. So it's not just enough to know what you don't want and what you want instead, which is a very important step to take, though. It's you need to know, like, well, what would life actually be like if you had what you wanted instead? And can you tolerate that? And what does it take to be doing that? And what would that look like? And can you handle that? So now you think of somebody who has trauma and they have processing problems and they can't think through what comes first, what comes second, and what comes third. Because that process, when they look at what they have to do to get to this place, that locks them up. And their brain, which is pretty tightly locked up with all the trauma, can't organize and sequence, right? Which means when I go to look at my day, and people wonder, like, why can't somebody, when they're depressed, just get up and take a shower? Because getting up and taking a shower has many steps to it. And when you have a brain that can't say naturally what comes first, what comes second, what comes third, then you have to teach somebody that process. So until you know what does the person want to release, what do we want to prune, and what do we want to be moving towards instead? And then a lot of times people won't even tell you what they want to move towards because they're too afraid to even think about that. So once you can say, well, don't think about how to get there. Let's just think about, like, what would it be? And once you get that, it's okay, great. And if we were able to get there, would you enjoy life in that way? Right. And then you can say, okay, well, we're going to have to chunk this down into what comes first, what comes second, what comes third. And then people can say, wow, this is possible. Now you put them into a psychedelic experience, and now they're going to be able to use the medicine to focus on their strengths and to really use the insight and the awareness in a positive way. And then when they come out of the experience, they'll be able to, then you can then do whatever, whether it's EMDR, whether it's just coaching them through it, whether it's building a plan, whether they need more skills and tools to pull together, some self-regulation, like then you know you can add that. But I have to say, I was recently interviewed by a graduate student from one of the universities and around integration. And she kept saying, you know, you keep stressing how important that biopsychosocial is and how preparation is so important. And I'm like, because so much of the work has to be done before you go into an experience sometimes. Some people are so ill prepared to prune and get what they want from that experience that you really need to, I call it like making a good layup shot for the psychedelic experience. And so, yeah, I think really understanding and organizing someone's life in a timeline and all the different things that may have had an impact on them. Like I have people who were born and were immediately taken from their parent for a medical procedure, you know, and they don't understand why they've always had anxiety. You know, and then some psychiatrists will say, well, you have generalized anxiety disorder. That's it. Here's some medicine. And it's like, whoa, wait a second. Like, how about let's try to repair this experience that they had. And maybe that will keep the body out of fight or flight. It's like in a nonverbal state of fight or flight all the time. You know, so this is where other herbal plant medicines or cannabis medicines can be really helpful, because if you have chronic anxiety, maybe the solution is let's get your body back into homeostasis using something that's non-intoxicating, but that actually works on the body's natural system, like your endocannabinoid system. All plants work on the endocannabinoid system, which is the system in the body that modulates all your other systems. So you strengthen that with some herbal plants or some cannabis medicines, And it doesn't have to be intoxicating, but you can help your patients reduce their level of fight or flight and then get in there to get the work done. And then you can introduce some psychedelic medicine to that as well. And you're going to have a really not, I just think from a pharmacology perspective, you're going to help the person. And then from an actual skills and tools perspective, you have a person who's more available to then teach them the self-regulation tools, what other skills that they need. So I had a man the other day who has severe OCD, and I taught them a really strategic type of breath work. And it was the first time that his thoughts completely quieted. And up until that moment, he felt like he had no hope to get better, that nothing we were going to do, no strategy, there was no ketamine, there was nothing that we were going to do to help him until he could experience his thoughts just completely shut down. And the minute he had that experience, he was like, I'm yours, whatever you want to do with me, just help. And I believe that you can help. So something like being a clinician who understands how to use a certain type of yogic breathing at the right time can be like so impactful. And that's why I believe in these integrative approaches, and understanding neuroanatomy and how to pull it together can be so impactful for our patients. So we really need to advance our mental health system past talk therapy.
Yeah, well, this is so valuable. Thank you so much. Appreciate the wisdom here. Another facilitator I spoke to, very, very powerful in his field of spending 30, 40 years facilitating plant medicines. I brought up the conversation around integration, and he said, if the preparation and the actual session was held and it was done properly, you won't need integration, he said, because it will be integrated instantly during the experience. So that was really powerful. Again, another whole insightful perspective. So I hear you, and I feel like your sharing and your understanding process is potentially the safest way as well. It's a very safe path to come into it.
So I think that maybe his comment is true for different types of stresses and distresses, and maybe even some traumatic stresses if you have a single event trauma. But I find with people who have developmental trauma, complex trauma, relational trauma, and several different traumatic events, that the integration does play a role, because you still need to, one experience might not be the healing for everything. Some people come with many different negative beliefs from, feeling powerless through many experiences, feeling safe through many experiences. So I do think that for many people, they do need the integration work, because that includes EMDR, which is still, you're still pruning. You can get awareness, but you still need to reorganize the system if their brain's been in lockdown for a long time. So although I agree with him for some cases, and I really appreciate the validation of really good preparation, I do think that integration is necessary for many people.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't want people to cheat out on that.
No, thank you for, again, reinforcing. I guess it's, everyone is unique, and everybody will have their own unique needs. Every process will be different for each one.
And we all treat different people, right? We all treat different people. So therefore we have different populations who respond differently.
Exactly. So he may be talking about certain populations, because it was, more like, coming from a more indigenous practices and so on. I'm guessing your integration probably may be different than just checklist of, journaling or doing this, or what does that look like, or what's the process like for you, or what would you say if you were to talk about the integration briefly?
So I think that when people are done with their experience, that journaling is really helpful. And I certainly think that when you give them prompts also, depending on who they are and what they need. And for them to journal is really an important part. Being self-reflective after your psychedelic experience is very important. I just deal with people who have, or I treat people and work with people who have either chronic pain and mental health or pretty significant traumatic stresses, chronic stresses. So I was told one time that I'm the person that they send people to when no one else has been able to help them. So maybe my population is a little bit more stuck than other people's. And so I use modalities of therapy afterwards, like EMDR, ego state work, internal family. I take some things from internal family systems concepts and I put them together and I use it for the repair work. So a lot of times the patients I see still need repair work. They need pain reprocessing protocols. They need to learn how to master their stress response because their body's still going there on other issues other than the one that we were dealing with for that treatment, for that psychedelic, for that ketamine-assisted therapy treatment. So there is a lot of work that we're doing because, you know, just because you have ketamine doesn't mean your pain's going to go away permanently, doesn't mean your depression's going to go away permanently. Because if you haven't dealt with the reason that it got there in the first place, you still have to complete the work. So I would say that that's probably why I have a more active integration, is because people are still actively doing their repair work.
Yeah, that makes sense. Again, thank you so much. So I know we're coming to end of our conversation, but there's so many things like and golden nuggets I'm hearing. Like, I just want to continue on, and I want to also honor your time. Hopefully we can maybe have you back in the future and follow your journey, because, you know, I feel like when I discover grounded facilitators in the space, like, it's like finding a gold mine. That's how I see it. And so thank you for doing the work that you do. One thing that I wanted to speak about is, so now we are seeing a growing number of facilitators in the space for psychedelic assisted therapy as the countries and states are becoming, or at least decriminalizing psychedelic medicine. Right. So your opinion, what are your thoughts? Because at the moment, there's a lot of discussions around, should every facilitator do their own work before they can serve? And so many like other, you know, perspectives coming up and conspiracies. You can imagine negative sometimes. What are your thoughts?
So I have two frames of reference, because I always say you should know who your speaker is. Number one, I am a trained mental health clinician. And as part of my training in New York City, you know, everyone had supervision. Matter of fact, you couldn't even take health insurance back then. So I've been practicing for like 30 years. So back when I started being a clinician, you had to have at least 7 years of clinical supervision before you could even be able to be noticed by insurance companies to help your patients, right? So to me, clinical supervision is huge, because it really, it gives an opportunity for you to share your experience in a session and how to better use yourself. Like in therapy, there's this thing called lending your ego. Well, if you don't know who your ego is and you don't know who your soul is, or your capital self, I know in psychology, people like steer away from the word soul, but if you don't know who you are as a person and an individual, I think it's very hard to help somebody and really use all of who you are. And I think the clinical supervision gives you feedback on how you're doing with that and how you could do it differently. But it also gives you an opportunity to hear other clinicians' perspectives and how they're practicing. Like, I love to learn from other clinicians, and I love to listen to what other people are doing, because there's a way to take that information and digest it and use it to help your patients. So I think clinical supervision is huge. And I think the other thing is, yes, you must do your work. If you are going to help somebody in their repair and you can't get yourself out of the way And you're, you know, if you have held in resentment or anger, or you have unresolved grief, that's going to be pretty hard for you to help somebody else through, right? And you can be in your process and have that awareness and be aware, like, ooh, like, I need to see this through a different lens, or I need to rely on my tools or my skills here because I'm starting to feel things, which is why you want to have supervision, whether you're a coach or a therapist, because you need someone who understands how to work these things through and how to not hurt your patients, right? So you want to, above all else, do no harm. That means you really need to go through the work yourself, so that, and also have the supervision that helps you to be a very clean instrument in someone else's work. So, whether you're a coach, we have coaches on our team. And I also think you need to know what your roles are. You know, a coach can't do EMDR, internal family systems, ego state work, but they can be aware of how a person's brain processes. They can teach them skills and tools for breathing, how to develop their brain, they can give them tools for. So they can guide people in terms of their, once you create a daily life plan and a schedule, to be there to keep you inspired and motivated and make sure you're using the skills and tools. So I think if we all worked together, the therapist can do the repair work and the coaches can support them along their journey. And I think that if we create the right protocols, then people can take those protocols and digest them and make them their own. You know, they don't have to be rigid just because they're created. You get to use your own wisdom and talents as well. But I do think you need to know who you are so that you don't hurt your patients, and you need good clinical supervision.
Thank you so much. Yeah, that is very clear and also very valuable. So now let's talk about your mission, what really drives you, and what are you planning, your future projects, and currently what you're working on, so that we can learn a bit more about, in the background, what's happening for you.
I wish I had like one simple answer, because I guess my life would be less busy if I did. I mean, I'm driven by people's pain and suffering. I think that no one should have to suffer and not have help that they need. And I think struggling in life is necessary, because it's how we decide what we want, is by experiencing what we don't want. But suffering and not knowing a way out is not necessary. And so I think everyone, when you become a clinician, picks their vulnerable population that they want to get behind. Like I said, I've been meditating since I'm 11, and I don't know how I would have survived this long in life without knowing how to connect internally to myself, and how important it was to connect to others and be a part of something bigger than I am. So I definitely have a passion. I have a foundation called the Can't Tell Foundation. And my goal of the foundation, so far we've used it to help pay for treatment for people who can't afford treatment. And obviously with my clinicians and my team, we use it for that. And also for my ultimate goal before I leave this planet is that we create centers that are around the country. And I mean, I would love for it to be around the world, where we treat children. I have a whole trauma treatment program, and it's a very integrative program, including exercise, nutrition, meditation, mindfulness, breath work, acupuncture, EMDR, ego state work, internal family systems. I would love to be able to responsibly use psychedelics at some point in time when it's appropriate with the older children that are coming out, who are just about to age out. I think that could be extremely helpful. But we use a very integrative approach, and we've been doing it. Like I said, I've been practicing for 30 years. I created that program back in 2010, and we've been doing it since. And it is so effective, whether you do it individually or you do it in group work. And I would like to do that for the children in foster care and then train other clinicians how to do applied clinical integrative mental health so that they could open up maybe a space or two in their practice where they see pro bono patients or reduced fee patients so that these more vulnerable populations can get good therapy. And, you know, so that is one of my goals, is to offer clinicians clinical supervision, which I currently do now. And I do offer trainings in applied clinical integrative mental health so that people can learn how to do this really thorough biopsychosocial, which includes how people process information and all of the stuff that we've spoken about so far, and learn how to apply that in a treatment plan, and also, you know, offer the patients a way of bringing that into their daily lives. So those are my big passions. And my other one is plant medicine. Like I've created over 200 herbal formulas from studying. I've studied with Cornell University in herbal plant medicine. And I've also, I study a lot of studies, and that's how I originally started creating compounds that actually support the body in quieting down the sympathetic nervous system and stimulating the parasympathetic nervous system. And so right now I have a line of plant medicines. We've only launched two of them, but they're called Shari B's herbal plant medicines, and you can find them online. But they one is for anxiety, and it really calms the body and elevates, it really calms the body. I mean, people use it instead of taking Xanax. So when people have to travel outside of the country, or when people want to come off their medications, they tend to use this formula, and it's really kind of tasty, and cinnamon and citrus and clove. And we have another one for pain, and that works extremely well on so many different types of pain. And that has more of a spearminty, pepperminty flavor, but it's made of, I want to say, about 10 or 11 different herbal plants. And so it has a unique taste, but in that area. And we've been using them with our patients, and we just haven't really marketed them much because we've just been giving them to our patients at the center, but they are available online now. And I think it's very helpful, because to have a non-intoxicating way of helping people get out of fight or flight and do some of their pain management, which doesn't cause any harm to their body, I think can be very helpful. And I'm very big into how we use cannabis responsibly and dosing and as a dosable medicine. And I'm part of the Society for Cannabis Clinicians. They put out tremendously, like, there you can find studies on their website, and there are amazing clinicians from around the world doing incredible work. And there's a lot of education there for people to tap into if they're so interested. But again, I work with Dr. Michelle Wiener at my office. We do medical marijuana recommendations, and then we work very closely with the patients on how to dose for their particular symptoms or illness or conditions. And I think that that's another important role for me, because I think it's a whole mind body. So the fact that we can use plant medicine, which we do in a way, and I think plants are very, when you understand how to use them, are helpful and not harmful. And to be able to work with nutrition and fitness and all of the integrative approaches along with the therapy protocols that we do, we can really make a significant impact for our patients in them taking charge of their health and well-being.
Wow. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. This is so valuable. You truly do carry the flag for the integrative and all-encompassing, you know, processes for the whole human, you know, looking at the person as a whole human and bringing everything together, as many things as possible, help them. Thank you so much. This is very, very valuable.
Well, thank you for having me, and it's a pleasure talking to you, and would be happy to come back anytime to talk about any one of the areas that we discussed today.
I would love to. I think we could easily do several in each one. There's so many things, so much value. So yeah, we would love to have you back. And in the meantime, where can our listeners, audio listeners especially, can find you?
So my website is connected.com, and it's spelled C-A-N-N-E-C-T as in Thomas, D as in dog. So at connected.com. And that is our social media as well, is at connected. So it's just connected.com, or at connected is, you can find our social media there.
That's brilliant. Thank you so much. And we'll have everything in the show notes. I will have all the links and also your products and everything that our listeners may be interested in. Again, thank you. It's a pleasure. It's been such a pleasure getting to know you.
Same here. Thank you.
Thanks everybody for joining us. Hope you guys enjoyed this session, and please do comment, share your experiences, ask a question. Don't be shy, and I will see you on the next one. Bye for now. Thank you so much for joining us. Psychedelic Conversations podcast is designed to educate, inform, and expand awareness. For more information, please head over to psychedelicconversations.com. You can also share with your friends or leave a review so that we can reach more people. You can also join us in our private Facebook group to keep the conversation going. This show is for information purposes only, and it is not intended to provide mental health or medical advice. Thanks for listening.